Could you briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah. So I'm David Reap, and I'm a associate professor of art history here at CSU. And I've been here for about 10 years. And in this department, I teach some of the general art history classes, but a lot of upper division stuff that focuses on art from the African continent. And then also as part of my appointment to CSU, the service to the university, I'm also the Associate Curator of African Art at our university art museum, the Gregory Alacar Museum of Art.
So could you tell us about your current project that's focusing on art, history, genealogy, and land rights in Southern Africa?
Yeah. So this is something that I'm really excited about. And it's been many years in the making. So when I was doing my field work between like 2007 and 2015, I was working in an area of South Africa in the Free State province. And within that province, there was, under the old National Party apartheid government, there was what was known as the Bantustan, or a homeland for individuals who were identified as South Sotho, which is just one of many cultures that you find in Southern Africa. And in that area, there were three kings that, you know, were kind of set up in historically, really had rights to the land and the landscape. And over time, as things changed with colonialism and with conflict, were, you know, kind of relegated to overseeing, you know, sort of small municipalities there. Currently, two of those three kings still have a position over land and a role in government in that region, and the third has been sort of written out of history in a sense. And when I was doing my field research, I was working with all three of them, and when I was looking at the visual arts and kind of their use and function in society, I started seeing that this third kingship that's sort of been kind of pushed aside, I'm suggesting that historically this kingship is actually the most senior and actually has right to the land and landscape and in current terms a position in the national government. So it's something that I'm kind of looking at how kingship, royalty, belonging has been determined up to this point. And I'm questioning those sources, which are largely looking at, you know, kind of European written, you know, books and bodies of research, rather than getting local perspectives and looking at things like culture and art and, you know, the role of maybe culturally sensitive activities and you know, sort of questioning these dominant narratives. So I'm excited about it for an art historian. It's pretty cool. And my hope is that it's not just an article that I write, but something that might have an impact. So that's the thing I'm working on right now.
How long have you been working on it?
So, you know, I've been writing about this really going back to my dissertation, which was 2011, and then doing subsequent work, have continued to work with these different kingships. And this has been a topic that has always been sort of in the back of my mind. And I promise you, probably 8 years ago, I started writing a paper about this, and it's still sitting on my desktop. And I've, you know, twice a year we'll get motivated to do it, and then something else will come up. But now in my, you know, my position here at CSU and sort of wrapping up some ongoing projects, I'm able to really focus fully on this. So my hope is that this will actually get done now.
Could you tell us about the several exhibitions of African art, including the Shattering Perspectives, an exhibition of African ceramics that you just wrapped up, and the catalog that you just published?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do stay fairly busy with work over at the Gregory Alacar Museum, and the last maybe 12 months were particularly busy for me because I was given the opportunity to curate or co-curate or organize four different Africa-focused exhibitions. And so One of the things that I kind of do on my own is we have a permanent gallery in the museum that is always dedicated to arts from the African continent. And so that's something that I'm continually working on and sort of revising from time to time. And so I did a little bit of updating in there. But three other exhibitions over the last 12 months were really involving students, art history students or art students or students that were enrolled in a seminar that I taught. One of them was focused on beadwork from Cameroon, so, you know, kind of west-ish Africa, west or central, and it was a from a collection that was gifted to the museum maybe over the last 4 years. There was a collector who had given a handful of these. I think we have maybe 20 or 25 of these beaded waist skirts, and they'd never been displayed before, and I've always thought they were just visually really beautiful. And in my world of doing African art history, it's a type of object, and the particular culture from Cameroon is one that's been really sort of understudied. Not a lot of work has been done research-wise or in museums, and so it was a nice opportunity to show these phenomenal pieces, but also to give students a chance to do some original research, so that was exciting. And then kind of coinciding with that, we had another exhibition that was sort of broader arts from Cameroon, so it was, you know, kind of going hand in hand with this very, very focused look of the Banajuli culture, which is the culture from which the beaded skirts were created from artists there. And we've been lucky to have been gifted other objects from Cameroon in other different like media and materials. So not just beadwork, but pottery, wood sculpture, metals, that sort of thing. And so there was another opportunity to just kind of show these really fantastic gifts that had come in fairly recently. And another student actually worked on that one and was able to do, again, some original research with that, which was pretty exciting. Both of those were fairly small scale. I don't think either of them had more than maybe 25 objects that were shown, which is still a lot of work, especially for a student doing research on top of everything else. But then the other exhibition you mentioned, the Shattering Perspectives, that was actually a huge show. And that was a culmination of a lot of work, and it's been an ongoing project for several years. So that exhibition stemmed from an art history seminar that I taught, probably 2, maybe 3 years ago. And it was a seminar that was specifically focused on African ceramics. And the reason why I had pitched this idea to do this seminar course was because our museum here, the Alucard Museum, since my arrival in 2014, has been gifted a huge collection of African ceramics, to where now our museum here in Fort Collins has the largest collection of intact African vessels really in this half of the world, however you want to divide it. I mean, it's like a top five collection in the world outside of the African continent, which is pretty spectacular. And so I'd always been wanting to do something with this and again, to get students involved in it. And so this class that I taught, we did a lot of kind of directed readings and discussions, but a lot of the work that students were doing, where they were assigned a number of these vessels, and then they had to do research on them specifically. And ceramics is another one of these kind of corners of African art history that has been sort of understudied. There's a lot of research on masking and performance arts and sculpture and you know, textiles and things, but pottery is an area that's been, you know, not really developed very fully. So it was a big ask to have the students try to dive in and do something where there's just not a lot. You know, it takes a lot of sort of original work and having to look outside of art history to get answers to questions that they were asking. And they all did really, really spectacular. And then through the course of that semester, they also had to come up with a proposal for an exhibition of all of these vessels and come up with the design, come up with all the signage, with the advertising, everything. So it was, you know, giving them an opportunity to do sort of real world museum work. And a lot of students at CSU are interested in museums. So that was kind of a cool thing to do. And then all of their research, their essays that they came up with, then I was able to distill, and that served as a lot of the text for the catalog that was published just this year. Well, last year, 2023. So it was really a special moment where we could have the pots on display and the student work that was really kind of being showcased, and this great publication with a lot of really cutting edge research, with a lot of great contributors. And so that was the big event in the fall at the museum.
How many students were actually involved in the process?
I think about 20, between 20 and 25. Yeah, my memory's a little bleak now because it took a long time to complete, but it was just around that like 20 or so.
Are there any like specific countries that the ceramics were coming from? Do you remember which ones those were?
Many. I want to say there were probably maybe 30 countries that were represented. And, you know, one of my goals as a researcher, but also as a curator at our museum, is to try to develop a collection that is what I like to say sort of encyclopedic, where we have arts that represent as many countries as possible, as many cultures, as many artists, individuals, as many types of media, and also a range of time frames. So, you know, we have some stuff that's a little bit older, but I also really want to emphasize contemporary work and artists that are still working today.
So you also recently published a chapter, Litoko, Continuity, mm-hmm. Change and the Future of South Soto Praise Poetry in the Epic World. Can you tell us a little bit about your book chapter and the book itself, The Epic World?
Yeah. So The Epic World was a project that's edited by Pamela Lospieth, I think, and she's a scholar that's working out of North Carolina. And about a year and a half ago, she kind of contacted me out of the blue and was just asking if I knew of anyone who was doing work on epic poetry across the African continent. And I unfortunately didn't and told her as much. And we just got kind of into a broader conversation, and she was asking if there is anything that I do in my own work that might fit within that. And I initially said no, I'm probably not the right person for this project. And we just kind of continued a dialogue, and it dawned on me that with some of my field work, part of that was participating in what's known as Lebulo in South Sotho society in Southern Africa, which is in English often referred to as sort of rite of passage or initiation school, that kind of a thing. And during that process, one of the aspects is for the participants to create a what I'm calling a poem or a praise poem that is kind of announcing their new identity after they've gone through this process of learning and becoming and kind of taking on new bodies of knowledge and understanding what it is to be a ideal male in South Sotho society. And so after going through that process, they reintroduce themselves to the community, they take on a new name, and they kind of will create this poem that kind of discusses their you know, the growth that they've experienced during this really trying process. And so I pitched this idea as maybe a new way of thinking about epic poetry, and she liked it. And so I kind of set off working on that chapter and wanted to look at how this oral art form has sort of changed over time. So I looked at some earlier recorded versions of these that go back to like the 1830s or 1840s, and then some others that were recorded, I think it was like in the 1970s and 80s, and then examples that I had recorded and documented during my field work, and was, you know, looking at content and length and you know, some of the structures with that, and you know, seeing where do we have the sort of continuity and where have things shifted in, and asking that question, well, why do we see these changes in this art form? So it was exciting for me because it's not art per se, at least from what I normally do. But it was really refreshing, and I really enjoyed it. It was a cool experience.
And can you tell us just a little bit about what the book itself covers, The Epic World?
Yeah. So it's a huge tome. And I mean, it has to be 50, 60, 70 chapters, and each chapter is looking at epic poem traditions from across the globe and from across time, And the editor has sort of divided it into different segments, some that are looking at more historical or written accounts, all the way up to, you know, contemporary accounts. And her goal was to really kind of expand this definition of how this idea of epic poetry has been defined. From my own experience and someone who's not really into poetry or literature, but, you know, when I think of epic poetry, it's, you know, I think of Beowulf or, you know, the Iliad or the Odyssey, you know, some of these booming sort of classics that are coming from this, you know, maybe dominant areas of the world. And so it excites me to kind of see this new sort of revisionist way of thinking and looking at different traditions and art forms that perhaps were overlooked previously and sort of bringing those into this broader conversation and also the definition of how we think about epic poetry and its impact on cultures and societies across the globe.
That's really interesting. So you've also been involved in an ongoing multidisciplinary project that's Africa Meets Africa.
Mm-hmm.
What's that all about?
Yeah, that's a project that's I've been excited about for a long time, and that was started by Helene Smuts, who's a South African individual. She formerly was a teacher, and while she was teaching in the public school system, you know, kept seeing a lot of disparities between sort of urban and rural, and certainly between things like race and class, especially when we're talking about a place like South Africa, and was seeing how a lot of rural learners were struggling when they were given, you know, what I might say sort of, you know, traditional textbooks. So for example, you know, doing math. I've always been bad at math. And I struggled even as someone who's a native English speaker opening up a math book. And, you know, she was sharing with me, imagine if English is your third or fourth or fifth language, and then all of a sudden you're given this math textbook. So she was really interested in exploring different ways of, you know, kind of problem solving indigenous knowledge systems and wanting to come up with different ways for building bodies of knowledge, and started with mathematics. And in general, the project will sort of focus on a key community or region and will bring together scholars from many, many different disciplines. So of course you have mathematicians, you have people that work in the sciences, you have archaeologists, anthropologists, historians. I myself was an art historian, and we would come together and write a book that kind of talks about the history of cultures and interactions in this particular region, and then would look at the visual arts as a way to teach things like mathematics. So for example, the facet that I was working on was looking at South Sotho beadwork and also mural arts that really involve a lot of mathematical thinking. So algebra, number sets, a lot of geometry, translations, reflections, all that kind of stuff. And it's evident in the beadwork and in a lot of these arts that are still very, very evident, especially in rural areas across South Africa. And we had a mathematician look at these and sort of deconstruct them and talk about the mathematical processes that are involved in creating a piece of beadwork. And then rather than giving a student a math book, we give them a bunch of beads, and we have a master bead maker walk them through the process, and they make these phenomenal works of art that they're also able to learn about it, their sort of history in their own cultures. And by the end of it, you say, well, guess what? You've been doing geometry. You've been doing algebra. It's pretty spectacular. And so there's a workbook that kind of goes along with it that, you know, is a way to just, you know, present different ways of learning and knowledge for a lot of STEM subjects.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What's some of the feedback that you've been getting from that?
It's a great question. So the project has kind of focused on a few target schools, and the initial feedback that I've seen is that math scores have increased over the period of a semester. So for example, in the South African school system, at least when I last was looking at this data, there is a standardized test that you can score anywhere between a 1 and a 7 for math. Okay, mm-hmm. Seven being the most proficient. And the sort of average for students at the beginning of a semester was to get a 3. And after going through the curriculum at one of the pilot schools, it had increased to a 5 or a 6. So, you know, that's one small sample, but it's really encouraging to see, moving away from, maybe traditional approaches to doing things like math or science and thinking about these phenomenal knowledge systems that have existed for centuries and really bringing them into the classroom. It's really an effective way for teaching and learning, or at least bringing a diversity of approaches to learning in the classroom.
Have you been able to travel to Africa recently, like in the last year or 2 years?
Not in the last several years. It's been before COVID was the last mm-hmm. time that I was in Southern Africa. That was in 2018 or 2019. My hope is that this coming summer, I'm hoping to take a trip to kind of follow up on that initial project that we spoke mm-hmm. about. Maybe sit down with some of the area kings and oral historians there to kind of flesh out a little bit more of those histories and genealogies. So fingers crossed that'll happen.
So going back to more of like you and your career, mm-hmm. what exactly led you to this field and career path?
Yeah, it's a good question. So my undergraduate degree is not in art history, it's in communications, but I always liked art history. And at the time, I was thinking about majoring in it and was sort of talked out of that because it wasn't really a practical thing. Avenue to pursue. And so I went on and worked for a sports marketing company for a while and just wasn't very satisfied. And so after doing that for about a year, year and a half, I had an acquaintance who was from the States and was marrying a individual in South Africa. And so was invited to attend the wedding and decided at the time to just kind of stay, quit my job, and this couple were going to be launching a nonprofit organization in Southern Africa, and so decided to give some time to assist them getting that sort of off the ground. And my role was to work with homeless populations, homeless males in the town of Harry Smith, which is in the Free State province, and basically was doing sort of a feeding project where I would go to area grocery stores and get, the day old bread and make soup and just go and hang out and see what's going on with these individuals. And over time, really kind of built relationships with them and then started figuring out or understanding why some of them were living on the street. And in many cases, it was just because their families couldn't afford to take care of them at home. And then in a few cases was able to meet the parents and families and really built these really pretty spectacular relationships. After my commitment was done, I came back to the U.S. and wanted to pursue art history. And so went to grad school for that, did my master's at University of Kentucky and then my PhD at the University of Iowa. And during that whole process, when it came time to find a thesis topic and then which later became my dissertation, the first thing I did was, well, I want to find the book on South Sotho art, because this is the culture from whence all of these guys that I had been spending time with were identifying with. And I learned quickly that there wasn't one. No one had ever done really any major body of research on South Sotho art and history. And so because of my familiarity from that time of volunteering, that sort of became my avenue of research, and the rest is history.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And what have been some of your most eye-opening experiences from your work and your research so far?
Wow, so many. I mean, I've lived, around about 5 years in Southern Africa, and have loved every minute of it. And I was there often doing field research, but really it was about making relationships and building relationships and just getting to know people. And it's kind of cool because I remarried a few years ago, and the best man at my wedding was one of these guys that I met who was a homeless, you know, living on the street at the time, and is one of my best, dearest friends, and is married, has children now. So being able to kind of be a part of you know, people's lives, you know, and my hope is always to be able to give back somehow with my work, you know, not to have it just be sort of a one-way relationship. And so, you know, I've tried to maintain contact in doing research and collaborations and things, and I've had some fairly good success with that. The memories, though, I mean, it's living in another part of the world is so eye-opening, and it just changed the way that I see really everything, you know. And in a place like the U.S. where I'm a white male, you know, I have a lot of privilege that goes along with that, and I don't think I was really aware of the extent of just how lucky I am as a result of it until I was put in a place where I was a minority, where for a time I didn't speak the language, you know, and had this very, very small glimpse of what it is to be, you know, an other or an outsider. And you know, that was an unsettling experience, but it really changed my outlook on life. And you know, that's something that I really value, maybe more than any other experience, things that happened or things that I saw or things that I was able to participate in, you know, research that I was able to do. My hope is that the impact it had on me as an individual is something that sort of trickles down with what I do here at CSU and when I'm teaching classes on the arts of the African continent or across the Pacific, you know, regions that are maybe outside of these sort of dominant narratives that have been built up over time with histories and art histories, and you know, encouraging students here at CSU to maybe think differently about their own place in the world and thinking about how we all have opportunities to contribute in different ways.
And what about some of the challenging aspects? What have those been like?
For in terms of research or?
Research and your work in general.
Mm-hmm. You know, the cross-cultural barrier is always a challenge. And as much as I have invested time and effort and energy and knowledge and maybe can offer insight on, you know, South Sudu art and history, you know, the fact remains that I am who I am, and there will always be this sort of divide and this sort of veil that, you know, might hinder understanding and interpretation. And so that's always a challenge, you know, not wanting to put my own ideas, but really wanting to prioritize local perspectives, local voices. You know, and it's tempting as a researcher to really kind of pursue, you know, ideas that in my own perspectives that may or may not necessarily align with local perspectives. And so that's something that I'm always aware of. Time and space is also a challenge. You know, I wish that I could get in the car and drive 30 minutes and be able to work with South Sutu artists or oral historians or kings or chiefs or whoever, and that's always a difficulty. In 2024, it's getting much easier with WhatsApp and with Teams and Zoom and all that stuff, so that barrier has been a lot easier to manage, but it's still a challenge, and things like accessing archives, you know, the distance is always tough, and I think will remain to be a challenge for the foreseeable future. But it's also nice to see how technology and these great advances on the African continent as well as across the world are making the world smaller and making, you know, things a lot more accessible. So my hope is that that'll continue to maybe make things easier for me down the road.
And finally, what's some advice that you would give to students and maybe early career professionals and academics?
You know, always be open to new things. Be open to new ideas and new perspectives. And if it comes to things like doing art history or doing field work, if there's an opportunity to be able to embed yourself in a community to do that, and to keep in mind that, you know, it's about relationship. You know, it's not just subjects and informants, but it's individuals, it's people, and keeping that in mind and being mindful of that, and learning a language. If you can embed yourself in a place that's different from what you're familiar with, and take it upon yourself to learn the language, it's life changing for you, and it opens so many doors. And it's, for me, just a great way to kind of show respect to communities that are perhaps different than where and how I grew up.
Okay, thank you so much for your time, Dave.
Of course.